You're here to listen to John Fry. John is going to talk to you about the Kairos ministry, which he brought to prisoners and their relatives in Australia in about 1990, and he's been involved in the ministry to prisoners and jails ever since. He tells me that over the last 4 years he's become deeply involved with refugees and asylum seekers and is a regular visitor to Villawood Detention Centre. And he maintains that that is worse than the prison system. He describes himself, when I was talking to him at lunchtime, as a very ordinary man off the street that the Lord put in the position that he's in now. I said it was a very brief talk. I don't believe John's a very ordinary man off the street at all. I think it takes something special to do what John does. And John, it's all you.
Well, first of all, I'd just like to acknowledge what a privilege it is to be here today and to share with you what I've been asked to do. I don't take it lightly, but I know that we're all going to walk together, because in a sense this is a journey. It's my personal journey over the last 20 years, which I'll share with you in half an hour. And if you have any questions or comments, please feel free to stop me any time, because I think that's probably the way to go. So here we go. My upbringing was from a loving but very conservative home in Perth. I married a lass, Margot. And back in 1958, we have 4 lovely children, 10 grandchildren, not out, still in for more batting. And I love the family. I love my family dearly. Having lost my dear wife 11 years ago, it's been pretty tough in that sense, in a very real sense. I've been profession. I'm a qualified accountant and involved in banking and finance all my secular working life. And I attend St John's Anglican Church, Beecroft. I've been a church organist for 45 years, retired about 12 months ago, or pushed out voluntarily, willingly. And so I've had a sort of a range of involvements. My Christian journey over the first 45 years was pretty slow and stodgy. I was a Christian, but I sort of just kept on moving along. And my involvements were really, my spiritual growth seemed to be a bit subservient to my secular activities. And looking back on that, I can see that's what happened until 20 years ago. And without going into any detail, I had a big jolt in my spiritual life. A local assistant minister really challenged me hit me between the eyes and said, "Are you going to be dinking about it, John, or not?" And I thought about it and I knew I had to it was a fork in the road. Yes. From then on, everything changed. Everything changed. My whole priorities changed. And it wasn't long before I became involved in the young people of the parish. One of them happened to be living with us at this stage. He was in full-on hard times, and he was a member of Prison Fellowship. And he and a group of other young people invited me out to Long Bay would have been mid-1985, and for a Saturday morning, just for a general visit. And that visit changed the whole course of my life. And of course, it's why I'm here, one reason why, it's why I'm here today. I was struck by the fact that these crims, I've never been inside a prison before. I had a negative view of prisoners and prison life. There I was. I knew God was calling me to do something, but I didn't know what. Something outside Leafy Cheltenham, where I live. And I knew that Saturday morning in Long Bay, when a murderer, I was talking to a murderer in his cell, and I was telling him about my son studying his HSC, which probably shouldn't have done even that, talk about family, but I was totally raw. And he said, "Oh, I'll pray for him, John." And then I came reeling out of his cell, thought, murderer, praying for my son. This is over the top. This is weird. This is amazing. Can't believe it. So I went home and spent the whole of the rest of the afternoon talking to my wife about it, and things just changed from there. But along the events, along the line, just after that came the AIDS scare, the upshoot of the AIDS, and particularly in the prisons. And I thought, oh, I don't know that I want to have too much to do with prisons now, with the AIDS. So I just let it lie low until I heard a sermon at my local church on Matthew 25:31-46. I was a prisoner, and you visited me. And insomuch as you did it to the least of these, you did it to me. You know that marvellous, challenging, stirring passage of Jesus talking about the kingdom and the future. So 5 minutes later, I found myself in Long Bay Prison. It really got me going. And I'd just like to now, that was back in the early 80s, when I would have been late 40s. And I'd just like to take you on a journey now. And through it, you'll see the mistakes that I've made, the things where it's clicked, and you can form all sorts of conclusions for yourself. In whichever category of situation, environment you might be in, because the things that I've done, the mistakes I made, and the things that I learned from will be applicable for each one of us. So, the wake-up call had been given to me. The early years of prison ministry, and I'll you read from some of these notes if you don't mind. I wrote them out yesterday because I thought there's things that I will not say that I wanted to say, and I'll kick myself afterwards. Some of you folk already will be visiting prisons. I'm sure there are some of you here already. Are there anybody here that visit prisons regularly? Right, have done?
In the past.
In the past, right, okay. So forgive me, because you'll know some of this, but the rest of the folk won't, and they may feel called even today to respond in some way. So I first entered Long Bay in mid-86 as a total novice. These days people are trained in prison whys and wherefores. I went in as a total novice back in 1986. No specific training. I was a church organist, as I mentioned, and I played the organ in chapel for Reg Clark, the then chaplain, each week. Quickly made friends in the process. Made a lot of friends with a lot of prisoners. And one thing else I noticed, that Jesus had already beaten me to the punch, because he's already been working away feverishly with amongst the crims through his spirit, converting souls. So the first thing I learnt was that Jesus is already there. He's outside the walls, he's inside the walls. I quickly gathered a long list of inmates to visit, one-to-one visits. They're very time-consuming, those sorts of visits. I was with Prison Fellowship, and I could only visit probably two or at the most each afternoon I went in. But I also found the joy of working side by side with other Christians who were also doing the same sort of work. So there's a lot of camaraderie in all of this work. As I said, I made some mistakes initially. I hope that I learnt, at least some cases. One thing that I did make a mistake about was becoming too possessive of the prisoners that I was visiting. And if I found somebody else was visiting that prisoner, I thought, well, why do they want to visit from this other person for? They've got me. I mean, it's just pathetic. But that's how I initially saw myself, the saviour, and so to speak. And I quickly pulled back. I learnt a lesson very quickly. Stupid, wrong, dangerous, John. Stop it. And I did. And when I was still working at Westpac, and I was up in the 27th floor in Martin Place with the Holy of Holies, the general management, and some of these ex-crims had come up and visit me, and you know they stuck out like beacons, and some of the other staff they'd sort of look, give me sly winks and grins, and but they were really quite understanding about it, and they knew where my heart really lay. At that stage, I was sort of thinking less and less about Westpac and more about Long Bay. Long Bay was far more exciting than jolly old Westpac. And the staff, they knew where I was at. So I thought, oh, this is a bit crazy. So I eased the pain for Westpac and myself by taking early retirement. Those were the days before we were given redundancies, by the way, too. One thing I also was a bit concerned me almost in the beginning was the general attitude at that stage of the public to crims and their families. And even more disconcerting was this attitude was also shared by many Christians. And many Christian local churches, you know, you just wouldn't take an ex-inmate along, you know, it just wouldn't fit. And I thought, oh, this is funny. You know, Christ died for everybody, and Jesus said, visit those in prison. And it didn't seem to stack up with the scriptures as I saw it. Anyway, but that's something that stuck with me, particularly the kids in the playground at school when they know their dads or their spouses or their dads have been in prison or are in prison, and they really copped it and do cop it quite rough, which is pretty terrible, but that's kids. Another very important thing that I noticed in my efforts to try and extend 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, beyond that, so I could get my visiting done, that I was drowning in the number of visits that I was, you know, would like to make, was asked to make. And I thought there's got to be another way of getting around this shortage of workers for the big harvest. Is it by us helping to train inmates to support each other or what? Because it can't go the way, keep going the way it is. It's just going to sort of collapse, or I'll collapse. And that's something I carried around with me for quite a year or two. But little did I know that the solution was just around the corner. Little did I know. You see, because I'm not the Lord, I don't have the big picture. I just tinker around at the edges. Another area of concern for me, which I still have not been able to really deal with in a meaningful way, is aftercare. The guys that get out, they do it tough. I won't go into that now, but I always think of the parable of Jesus' story of the Good Samaritan. He just didn't rescue the guy. He made sure that he was continually looked after by the innkeeper. And that's an incredibly important part of the whole ethos of prison ministry, the aftercare of the ex-prisoners and their families. We do it to some extent, and we'll never get it totally right. Another little anecdote. I mentioned earlier that I was a bit fearful about going into prison because of the onslaught of the AIDS, and then that was dealt with, you know, but I thought to myself, I hope I don't come across any inmates who have got HIV or AIDS, but of course you don't really know. But one thing I do know, that one day I was asked by the governor, who had been discussing with one of my inmate friends this whole subject. That stage in Long Bay, the AIDS unit was segregated from the rest of the prison. And I'd been asked by the governor to visit the AIDS unit each week or two. And I thought to myself, this is a bit ironic. Something I've been dodging, and now I'm getting thrust in the middle of it. So for 2 years, each fortnight, I thought, oh, well, to heck with it all. I went, and I made some great friends. And I used to sometimes pick up a mug and think, I wonder if anybody's had this mug. I wonder if there's any germs, you know. And then I started off by just tipping it out. And then I thought, oh, to heck with it. Down the hatch. And I still survive to this day, but I won't go into any, some of the details, but it was quite harrowing. Now, by 1990, and this I'd started off in the prison system in mid-86. I was actually then chairman of New South Wales PF, and two others and I were asked to visit the United States to have a look at a program called Kairos, Greek for God's Special Time, which had been effectively operating in the US systems for some 20 years. Effectively operating is putting it mildly, very effectively operating. And our US friends, via the Emmaus community, and you've heard of the Emmaus community, Casillo, were invited to attend an observer program in Rayford Correctional Institution, Florida. Florida's in the news at the moment, isn't it? And they very graciously said, look, fellow Australians, you can have our system. We'll help you put it in. It's a free gift from us, from God through us. This is how we responded. And there's a certain amount of head hanging in this. We were convinced that it was, after having seen it, it was God-given, it was God-inspired, God-breathed, and it would work in the Australian prison system. We went to see the then Deputy Premier, Bruce Baird, a good friend of ours, who's now in Federal Parliament. And he took us to introduce us to Michael Yabsley, the Corrective Services Minister at the time. And with the Corrective Services Department all in favour, yes, we'll give it a go. Fantastic. But what happened? Once we got back from the USA, we started to do the rounds of the churches and other Christian organisations, the chaplaincy, and it didn't seem to sort of quite gel. In fact, it took 5 years to get that first program in to Parramatta Prison, 5 years after we got back. Having had at the very beginning the okay of the government. So what actually happened? Well, here's what the response within the Christian community was. Kairos. What's Kairos? Well, I started to say, well, Kairos is blah, 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 but you need to experience it. It's hard to explain. But would it work here in Australia? I mean, it's different. We're different. This is the Christian community. Don't we have enough Christian prison ministries already? We've got the chaplaincy, we've got prison fellowship, We've got other specific Christian ministries that go in there. Or who would actually run it? Now, this is where it's getting to the nub of it, i.e. control it. Would it be the through Prison Fellowship, of which I was then chairman? Would it be through the chaplaincy? Or could it run itself? It couldn't run itself. And when we went to see the church denominational leaders in Sydney, most didn't really want to know us. A couple did, but most didn't. So what was the sticking point? Surely it couldn't be the Christian community. I mean, after all, we're all one in Christ, aren't we? And the Bible keeps telling us that there's to be unity even in diversity. So surely, weren't we being unified? No, we weren't. The enemy lay from within, friends. And all I could see, and I was partly culpable with others in that, but what I could see was that all those prisoners that would otherwise would experience Kairos in Australian prisons were being denied it. And they were denied it for 5 years. And we almost gave up. One of the guys that I was working with, Cliff Powell, he's a partner of Graham Barker, who was giving the talk here just before lunch. And Cliff and I thought, well, it's almost too hard. We'll give up. But we'd made two important decisions. We thought, do we really need to start as big as they do in the US, where they have 54 inmates for each program? Let's just chop it in half. Go small. And do we really need signed agreements from all the leaders of the denominational churches? I mean, who cares whether we've got their signature on a piece of paper or not? I mean, this was sort of really drastic sort of thinking. But it seemed to do the trick, because a couple of weeks later, the first miracle happened, that Prison Fellowship said, yes, you can run it off on a pilot. The national body of PF said, you can have a pilot. And so a lot of hectic activity, and involving some friends of ours in corrective services, the regional director of corrective services, the governor of Parramatta Prison, George Clark, and the prison chaplain, Jim Thompson, some of you may know. And the second miracle was that in the second half of, in the middle of 1995, June 95, we had our first program in that prison. 23 fairly heavyweight criminals lined up, and they had their lives transformed. And that was the second miracle. And the Lord had clearly intervened and come to our rescue when we'd given up. And there's a big lesson there for me. So where to from Parramatta? Well, in our usual speedy way, it took 18 months to determine where our next ongoing prison would be, and we took a pragmatic decision that it would be in Long Bay, where it so happened the chaplain, Ron Watts, had been an observer at Parramatta, and he liked what he saw. And Long Bay was close to us in Sydney, and it happened to be a minimum security prison, but we thought, well, let's start off with a kindergarten and work our way up. And so that's what happened. In October 1996, we had our first ongoing program in Long Bay, and it was great. Never forget some of the characters there. There was Chris Cusack, the prison officer, who I'd known for about 15 years in the Bay. Fairly seasoned, cynical character. He was assigned the task of being the activities officer. So it's his job to make Kairos happen from an operational point of view. It'll never work, John. These guys can see through you. You're all care bears. And they're not interested. Well, it so turned out that they were interested. And one of the guys that came in, and we invite people in, and they're all the heavies in the prison system, was a guy called Megsy. And he was an ex-bikey, and he was tough as tough. And big, long, curly hair, and tats and everything. And he was a real leader of the system. But he got the idea, yeah, I'll come along. Bit of a new experience. And he dragged along a whole lot of other of his mates. and he had a ball. He had a ball. They all had a ball. Chris Cusack was swept off his feet with what he saw. And Chris Cusack has now become a strong Christian and an ongoing active involved member in Kairos itself. That's dear Chris. After Long Bay, Kairos continued to expand rapidly through New South Wales. The prison population now in New South Wales, sadly, is climbing. It's over 8,000. We had our 10th anniversary of Kairos in Australia in June last, and as of then, there had been 3,600 inmates who had been through a Kairos program. 3,600. Currently it's running at the rate of 600 per annum, and the guys are queuing up to get on the program. That's amazing stuff, isn't it? I kid you not, this is what's happening. And remember I mentioned earlier my dilemma about resources, workers for the harvest? Well, over that period, there's been some 5,000 Kairos volunteers that have gone into the prisons. So we have the volunteers. They too are being greatly blessed. In addition, there are thousands and thousands of other Christians on the outside involved in prayer ministry, structured prayer ministry, and baking cookies. You know how many cookies we consume on an average Kairos over 3.5 days? 1,500 dozen. That's a fact. And they're all prayed over beforehand, so that makes it a little bit more digestible. We give them to the prison officers, we give them to the inmates, we give them to the inmates' mates, and we give them to ourselves. So that was the Lord's answer for me to the prayer of workers for the harvest. And the workers multiplied, the harvest seemed to get bigger and bigger and bigger as well. In addition to the inside program, we have two other arms of Kairos. One is Kairos, called Kairos Torch. It's for juvenile institutions. We've had something like 200 or 300 young, serious juvenile offenders up in Carrion, Gosford, have been going through our program. And I would actually be on a program right now, or next month, if I hadn't have taken sick a few weeks ago. And actually, what you see now, by the way, is not what you normally get. Whenever I look at myself in the mirror at the moment, I shudder. I think, who's that skeleton? Because I've lost a lot of weight, you see. And so I had to pull out of the program. It would have been my first program as an ordinary team member for Torch. But I missed it. But the other one is Kairos Outside. That's for women folk who have loved ones who are incarcerated, albeit husbands, de factos, brothers, uncles, fathers. And these women really do it tough. They really do it tough. And we have a special weekend for them in which we mollycoddle them. When I say we, other women. I've been a member of the support team, assistant bottle washer in the kitchen, which I enjoy because it's a bit of a bludge. and you get to talk to the women too. We sneak a few talks to the women, and you wait on the tables, and they love that. They have the men waiting. I said, "Oh, I didn't know the men that would do this sort of thing." I said, "Oh, no, I don't usually do it myself." but it's a great program, and it's some 500 or 600 women have been through the program already, and it's continuing to flow on. And it's a counterpart to what we give the men inside the prison. So the men, when the men go into a kairos and comes visiting time, after the first 3.5 days of the first kairos, visiting time, and the guys are sort of, many of them have changed. Like I'll explain a little bit later on, it's transformational. And it's quick. And the women come in, And they can't believe what they see. Is it? Hey, what's wrong with you, Fred? You sick or something? Or you're on drugs, are you? So this is a sort of counter it, so that the women get some understanding of what their loved ones have been through on the inside. It's a great program. Now, perhaps a little bit about how Kairos works. You think, well, you know, am I just talking hot air? How can this really be? Anybody done a Kairos?
I'm going through a program at the
moment. Which one's that?
15
Silverwater. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Great. Terry, I spoke with Terry here this morning. He's going on it too. The mission statement for Kairos is to bring Christ, love and forgiveness to all incarcerated individuals, their families and those who work with them, and to assist in the transition to becoming a productive citizen. And the purpose is to build strong Christian community within correctional institutions using a carefully planned and executed strategy and method. And everything done is directed towards building team and groups within the institution. So we build the Church of Christ in the prison system. And so we say to the guys, who is the Church? And they respond, we are the Church. Who is the Church? We are the Church. Got the idea? And so the church is already there. The chaplain is the pastor. And we go in as lay helpers. And that's the concept which I struggled with in my early days with prison fellowship. There's got to be something different. And for me, this was it. Kairos is interdenominational, a lay-run ministry for use in men's, women's and juvenile correctional institutions under the auspices of the chaplain and with the approval and active support of corrective services and the governors of the prison. Team members are selected from Emmaus, Casillo and similar three-day street movements. Most of you familiar with Emmaus and Casillo? Yep. Team members participate in over 30 hours of intense team formation and bonding prior to entering the prison. A disparate group of people get together 10 to 12 weeks beforehand, and we've got to get to know one another. And that's what happens. That's what the bonding, the training's all about. It's very labour-intensive. Kairos is extremely labour-intensive, with team members numbering well in excess of inmates. So for an intake of 24 inmates, you would have a team number of 40. That's including the use of computers. Almost all inmates attending a Kairos course have little or no exposure to Christianity. That's the inmates. We take mainly the heavies, the leaders. Some Christians, obviously, but we don't. We just as soon have Christians or non-Christians, Muslims, Hindus. Each prison receives one short course of 3.5 days each half year, with approximately 24 new Kairos inmates at each course. The short course itself draws on the Emmaus and Casillo method of table families, team member talks, and so on and so on. That's the operational side. The underlying theme is the love of God in Christ. And underneath that, the features include forgiveness. Forgiveness, tremendously important for all of us. No less so those who have committed murder, rape, and other heinous crimes. God can never forgive me. Yes, he can. And he does. You've just got to ask him and change your life around. Repent. And he's forgiven you. No matter what society does and thinks, God has forgiven you. Sometimes that takes a while to sink in, as it does us. Part of the ceremony is a ritual burning of names that they compile over the 3.5 days of people they need to forgive the most. Some of those names include themselves. Some of them include the local prison guards. Some of them include their accomplices in crime. I've mentioned the table families, talks, discussion, bonding. Fine food, not jail food, fine food prepared by our own team on the outside. Prawns and all the luxuries of life which make the prison officers' mouths drool as they see it coming in and smell it coming in. The famous cookies, as I mentioned. Plenty of smokos. You couldn't run a program of 3.5 days without copious smokos. And a closing ceremony. The closing ceremony is something again to behold. Anybody been to a Kairos closing ceremony? Yeah. Okay, you know what I'm saying. Amazing experiences, aren't they? And the guys get wheeled in. They don't know there can be anything up to 100 to 300 visitors to the prison. It transforms the whole prison scene. And the visitors are already there waiting for when the inmates who have been carefully put somewhere else while the guests arrive get wheeled back to the tune of "When the Saints Come Marching In." Some saints. And then they get wheeled up to the stage in front of the mic, and then there's huge groans because they know it's on. They're going to be asked to testify. And they've asked three questions. What spiritual condition did you arrive in? What did you learn here? And what are you going to do about it? Well, the responses, you've heard the responses. But many of the guys make confessions to Christ. You get some funny answers, but they're all positive and they're all amazing. And it's very affecting of all of us. And that's the end of the 3.5 days, but the beginning of the ongoing journey program, without which the 3.5 days could be more of a liability than a help, because you'd leave them up in the air stranded. And going back in the compound, what do they do? We go back week after week, with more sustenance, quite a bit of Bible teaching, some practical stuff, visitors, and in some cases preparation for when they get released. So Kairos is 52 weeks of the year, year after year. And as the intakes build up within the system, the numbers of Kairos inmates build up, and the compound, the environment in the compound, changes. For the better. They don't fight so much anymore for queues up in the phone box, or belting somebody for being too long on the phone, or whipping some ice cream away from somebody. you know, those sorts of things get minimised. Another great advantage, anecdotally, we found that, well, not anecdotally, but actually, in the prison system, some 70-75% of inmates have already been in at least once before. The revolving door. With those who have been through Kairos, that ratio percentage drops dramatically to something around about 13%. The media has not understandably taken some interest in us, and we oblige without going overboard, but we do not need the media. And they think they've got that sort of message. Our response, media response, is favourable, but we don't really mind. The best thing about it is it helps other people to see that Christianity is alive and well. I've mentioned the problems with post-release. I'd like to just give a couple of true stories, which indicate that not everything in the prison system when we go in there is deadly serious. You know, I always try to be myself, and I'm not always a deadly serious person. I've been on my sick bed for the last 3 or 4 weeks, and I've been deadly serious about that. But I'm starting to recover, and my sense of the ridiculous is starting to reappear, which is good. But one year at Long Bay, we had a Christmas pageant, Christmas story, and the inmates ran it, produced it, acted it, and they had one little guy, I've forgotten his name now, a little fat guy from Syria, Roly Poly, lovely guy, and he was Jesus, and he was just dressed up in a nappy. And then Joseph was a guy called Daniel Rossetto, who's a big, tall, tough Italian guy. And he was having a drink one night in the Bethlehem pub with the sign, Tui's on tap. And he was talking to some of his mates, and he said, "Hey, we heard about Mary. What's going on with Mary, Joseph?" And he said, I don't really know. There's something, but anyway, she's expecting, as you know. And he looked around, and he said, "Hope it wasn't any of you blokes." He said, "Nah," he said, "you're not good enough for Mary." and he went home, and he started to have his dream about things, and it was a real scream. And another time out at Emu Plains, there was another Christmas pageant, and they had the little baby. They had Mary arriving with a little baby Jesus. Mary was an inmate of Emu Plains, Maria, her name was, and came in with a donkey with a straw all over the prison floor, the hall of the prison floor. And a whole lot of animals out and just outside. The whole place was transformed again. Yeah. And I was a shepherd. And then I got the message about the baby Jesus. So I was lying down on the feet up. And people said I ought to put new soles on my shoes because I've got holes in my shoes. But that's by the by. And I went to see Mary and Jesus, and I said, this was not in the script actually, I said, "What a fine baby, and what colour eyes has he got?" And of course, I don't think we know what colour eyes he had, did we? And I said, and what was his birth weight, Mary? Which was a bit cheeky because we know what his birth weight was either. But that was a great night too. And So we have these, and another funny one was on an updated version of the Prodigal Son, and the Prodigal Son, of course, was a prisoner in Long Bay, and he was kept ringing up his father to see if his father would have him home, and he wanted to borrow more money and stuff. But that was a very funny thing too. The inmates themselves formed a choir called the Freedom Singers, but came out of Long Bay and also Emu Plains. And they were given permission by the authorities each Sunday morning to go out into the local churches and sing and testify and have lunch with the assembled congregation, some of whom sort of could hardly believe their ears and eyes. Bit of a wake-up call for some. But that was a great ministry. I think it's been disbanded now. But for some years, they had this ministry of sharing with the local churches. It's great stuff.
What sort of penetration have you got in the jail? How many
prisons?
Yeah.
Well, we're in all but about three or four. The prisons we're not in. The ones I've been trying for years and yonks is Lithgow. That's Max. Then just a couple of smaller ones like St Helier's at Musselbrook. But we're about to go into Parklea. So we're basically, we're in all the other, we're in the women's prisons. So we're in them all. Interstate's been a bit of a slightly harder go. For various reasons, which I won't go into, but our aim is to have representation in all states in 2 years' time, and we're working towards that now. One thing, there's been a caution, right? The biggest caution, the biggest trap that we can fall into and have from time to time is our very success, and that tends to breed a feeling of, well, aren't we the greatest, you know, and all we've got to do is go to corrective services and ask for this and ask for that and we'll get it, you know, blah blah blah, terrible stuff. And we've have fallen on our faces a few times with some people that have just gone totally overboard. And of course, that's really one of Satan's greatest manoeuvres, is to work from within. We'll continually have to work at this. Nearly there. I suppose over all the years, and particularly getting Kairos going in Australia, we have had our disappointments, setbacks, and et cetera, et cetera. Even, as I said, within our own ranks in the early days. Mercifully, that part's behind us now. But we still have, there are still obviously critics. But I've always been very encouraged by the words of Gamaliel speaking to his colleagues at the time they were roughing up some of the disciples, Peter and some of the other disciples. And Gamaliel said to his colleagues, "Keep away from these men. Let them alone. For if this plan or this undertaking is of men, it will fail. But if it is of God, you will not be able to overthrow them. You might even be found opposing God." But if we keep in tune with God's will, he'll never let us down. And that's been my experience with all these last 20 years in ministry. And just finally, if I might just say that in the last 4 years, I have moved more and more away from the ordinary penal institutions as more and more people have come in as I mentioned, thousands of people coming in. I've long since relinquished any administrative organisational planning stuff, and it's in very good hands, and the program's in very good hands. And so I have stepped back. My primary ministry is with Frontiers, which was reaching out to Islam in overseas unreached Muslim people groups. And that's where I'm moving more and more towards. But as in a transitional sort of a way, I became involved with refugees and asylum seekers because I suddenly felt these people are getting the rough end of the stick. And I began to realise that, yes, Jesus did die for the whole world, not just the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants like me, but for everybody, for the Middle Easterners, for the Chinese, everybody. And that led me, immediately post Tampa, I became incensed with what happened. And 5 minutes later, as Matthew 25 had moved me all those years ago, quick fast, so the Tampa moved me, God's word moved me again, in so much as you did it too. I died for these people. And I had the experience of reading about Peter visiting Cornelius in Acts 10. He did so out of obedience, but he wasn't all that fussed about Cornelius because Cornelius was a Gentile. And he was a bit high-handed. And I was that way too with these people. So immediately post Tampa, I got shaken out of my socks, and I started going to Villawood. For the last 4 years, I've been visiting Villawood Detention Centre each week, and that's been one of the most harrowing emotional experiences of my whole life. And I haven't got time to go into any more detail now, but it's been life-changing. But it brought home the reality to me of the passages. Jesus came into the world to die for us all, the whole world. And in the process, there was a liberation for me. John 8:32-33. You will get to know the truth, and the truth will make you free, and you will be free indeed. So I became free over these last 2 or 3 years in a new way. And there's been a high cost for me personally, but I would never change it. I would never change it. I think that's about all I want to say. This is really part of the great love story of God loving us and us loving each other. It's as simple as that, isn't it? And I just want to sort of again share with you one of my favourite last hymn. The last verse of one of my favourite hymns. I think some churches still sing it. When I Survey. The fourth verse. Were the whole realm of nature mine, 'twere an offering far too small. Love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all. Thanks, everyone.